This program is sponsored by Citadel Securities.
The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents, featuring a discussion by Alan Millett entitled The Siege of Bastogne, the Key to Allied Victory. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. This program is from the 2019 On War Symposium, which focused on the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge and was sponsored by Citadel Securities. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. In this episode of Pritzker Military Presents, Dr. Millett and Jay Williams dive deeper into the Siege of Bastogne, exploring how it was the key to Allied victory in the Battle of the Bulge. The lecture covered the lead-up to the siege, focused on the significance to both sides of the city of Bastogne, the attack itself, and its effects on the Allies and German commanders and servicemen. Retired Colonel of the United States Marine Corps Reserve, Alan R. Millett received the 2008 Pritzker Military Museum and Library Literature Award for Lifetime Achievement in Military Writing. In January 2006, he began a professional appointment in the History Department at the University of New Orleans as Director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies. He also serves as the senior military advisor at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. Interviewing Dr. Millett is a frequent Pritzker Military Presents guest and host, John Allen Williams, United States Navy retired. He is a former professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago and holds degrees from Grinnell College and the University of Pennsylvania. Please enjoy this episode of Pritzker Military Presents.
When you ask any American about World War II or the Battle of the Bulge, they all know the name Bastogne. It's a familiar word for everyone, but the details of it are not as well known. Professor Alan Millett knows everything interesting that there is to know about Bastogne, and as we go back a long time, and many other things. And I know he's going to be sharing them with us today, looking forward to it. But I understand from our discussion just now that you were actually in Bastogne.
Yes,
now.
I want to tell everybody that Bastogne has a summer, which probably is not something that we're aware of. One of the things about Bastogne, it'll always be remembered as a place that was really cold. And it's sort of like the Chosin Reservoir, you know. It's hot in Korea, too, but you don't sometimes remember that. But, the Bastogne is a very, very pleasant provincial town in Belgium, southeastern part of the country. And there's a marvelous relatively new museum there, which I would encourage everyone to visit. It's a little tough to get to, but it's certainly worth the trip. I have a personal interest in it because one of my former students was a Belgian named Peter Shrivers, is one of the key advisors to the museum, and he's written now 5 books about the Ardennes, the Battle of Bastogne, and he actually puts not only Germans but Belgians. Peter can work in 4 languages, so he's very, very, very good. He's a talking head on the new American Heritage documentary on the Battle of the Bulge, which is pretty well done. So the attention to the American war effort in the Ardennes in 1944 is very much alive in Europe, which I'm pleased to report. And if you remember the name Peter Shrivers, look it up, you'll see some really good books, as well as Charlie McDonald's Time of Trumpets. Trevor Dupuy did a World Battle of the Bulge book, Anthony Beaver has. It's sort of like when you're in military history, you have to write about Clausewitz, otherwise you're nothing. Well, in World War II, you have to write an Ardennes book, but sort of keep up your credibility, I guess. I haven't done that, but I certainly have been interested in it because I've been a kind of historian of the 101st Airborne Division. So I got involved in this some time ago, and I first went to Baston probably 30 some years ago. So I feel pretty close to the subject, and the fact that I was there this summer makes it even more immediate. But I wasn't cold. I've been cold, done that, So to be in Belgium in the summertime is a whole lot better than being there in December.
Well, the one time I was there when I was on active duty doing something or other in Belgium, as I recall, we went to there, and there was like a sort of a rotary in the center of town with an American tank in it. And I thought, well, somebody likes us.
Yeah, oh, they still remember the campaign. And one of the things that Peter does in his writing is to talk about the campaign from the standpoint of the Belgian civilians who got caught in the path of this tremendous battle. And certainly they're the victims of this whole thing. I might add that they're also victims of Nazi atrocities. There are, I think, many more Belgian civilians mm-hmm. shot during the Ardennes campaign than American POWs. They know that. We don't. Quite frankly, I think we lose track of everybody else's casualties but our own, and so there's no great surprise.
Well, not to mention what the Germans did to them in World War I after
yes,
being slowed
exactly.
down.
The Belgians are really lucky. They've been occupied twice and trashed.
Well, Alan, I note maps here, and maps. That tells me this is going to be authoritative. And
the audience is so old. They're not demanding. I don't have to come up with lots of pictures and stuff. A couple of maps will make them all happy, I hope.
Imagine presentations without PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Why, yes,
great.
We all can. We can remember.
Right.
But I'll bet you can use this map and tell us, among other things, why Baston? Why did that place, of all the places in Europe, suddenly become so significant strategically?
Well, it is a big road junction. I think there's seven different what passes for a highway in the Ardennes that run through Baston. One of the things that we don't get in some of the books is to realize that Baston is a plateau, and so all the roads are going up into the town. The town actually sits on kind of the side of the plateau. And so anybody who defends Baston, in a sense, has the advantage of higher terrain. It's also very highly compartmentalized, too. It's very rolling countryside, lots of little brooks and rivers. And it's it'd be a nightmare to attack, but a pretty good deal for a defender as long as they have plenty of ammunition, which fortunately the Americans did eventually. But when the German effort to the north by the 6th Panzer Army began to stall, then the 5th Panzer Army's sector got much higher attention because the feeling was they weren't going to get to Antwerp. I think most of the German generals knew that. But they had what they called a short solution, which was to try to get to Liège and move in behind at least some substantial parts of the 1st Army and certainly be a disruptive campaign, which would certainly prevent the Americans from jumping the Rhine anytime soon. So it was kind of a preemptive attack. I don't think that they didn't have the gasoline or the troops or the wherewithal to get all the way to Antwerp. I think most of the German generals knew that. But there was some reason to continue the campaign, even when getting to Liège looked like it was pretty tough to do. Remember that the 6th Panzer Army's attack to the north had already begun to stall after about 4 days. And so it looked as if there was a better opportunity to shift the emphasis to the south and then swing around to the west and up behind the 1st Army. The campaign of Baston is important, but there are others. The defense of Saint-Vite is important. There are a number of engagements, probably as many as 10 which have played some role in slowing down the German offensive. It took about a week for the Allies to really get their act together. Montgomery takes over the northern sector. The British 30 Corps gets involved. The 18th Airborne Corps is taken out of theater reserve. All this takes time. I think what's quite amazing is that the decisions that proved to be critical were actually made within the first 48 hours. I mean, surprise, yes, but surprise is a relative thing. Both the G2 of the First Army and the G2 of the Third Army had worried about the buildup, in the Ardennes.
And so they did see that buildup.
Yeah, and so there were, Patton, for example, already thought about changing the direction that his army was pointed. It was pointed east. He'd have to point it northwest. Sometimes we don't realize that the Third Army was already pretty far to the east, and so it's not just a matter of turning around and going north. They actually have to go northwest to get in the position to launch a counterattack into the Ardennes area. So surprise, I think, is a relative thing, I think the response was pretty rapid, actually. I mean, Ike had worked it out. Attacks start on the 16th of December, and within 3 or 4 days, they had figured out exactly what the Germans were up to and had already taken action. The 18th Airborne Corps got alerted and then sent within 48 hours from the time the German attack began. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten to Bastogne. In fact, the 101st wasn't even supposed to go to Bastogne. They and the 82nd Airborne were headed towards Saint-Vite. They were going north. It turned out the roads were clogged, and then Middleton and some others said, hey, how about Bastogne? We need some troops there. 28th Infantry Division was having a hard time. They'd been fighting for 2 days and pretty well had it. Somebody should give a presidential unit citation to the 110th Infantry Regiment. They basically fought a German corps to a standstill. There's a great little town called Clairvaux, which is actually, the fictionalized account is the novel and the movie Castle Keep, which is a little weird but still interesting. There's a sideline, I should say, that we have unusually rich literature in fiction on the Battle of the Bulge, particularly this part of it, because the Army had sent all of these schoolboys from the Army Specialized Training Program as riflemen in the infantry divisions in Europe. Now, these are all guys who are GCT 120, and they've been deferred to get college degrees and be commissioned, and then suddenly, why do we have 120,000 privileged intellectuals sitting in universities when they should be carrying M1s? So somebody sent all these intellectuals. They all turned into novelists and screenwriters. It must have been crazy. Lieutenants looking around, and guys are taking notes for their novel. A Midnight Clear, for example, is written by an ASTP guy. Memoirs. I mean, it's hard to find memoirs written by sort of normal infantrymen for World War II, for the European theater, because it's all these guys, most of whom wanted to be officers. We found out that a lot of the people who were disgruntled about the Army were perfectly happy if they become officers, and that wasn't going to happen. These guys, they were good soldiers, but they weren't happy soldiers, let's put
so
it that way.
At the beginning of this, the Germans attacked, and could you just refresh our memories physically, what did the Germans do, and who of the Americans were there in Bastogne at the time or nearby?
Well, the U.S. 8th Corps had this part of the front, and they had, the 104th Division to the north, 28th Infantry Division to the south. 28th Infantry Division is Pennsylvania National Guard. They're called the Bloody Bucket. division. They'd been hammered in World War I. They got hammered again in the Hurtgen Forest in World War II. And they had some replacements, but they were under strength. And they were given a frontage, as I recall, of about 6 or 7 miles. And they had to man it with 3 under-strength regiments, so that they had a single under-strength battalion as division reserve. Now, they had attached tank destroyers and tanks and stuff, but they weren't overly blessed with help. And they got attacked by 2 Panzer divisions, or Panzer Grenadier divisions. And they had a tough time. 48 hours, division pretty much fought its way into exhaustion. But the 110th Infantry actually fell back towards Bastogne, which was the 8th Corps headquarters. Wiltz, another town just east of Bastogne, was the division headquarters. Division commander was Dutch Cota, who had been the assistant division commander of the 29th Infantry Division at D-Day, better known as Robert Mitchum with a big cigar running around. But he was a real deal. And a friend of mine named Bob Phillips, who was there, wrote a book called To Save Bastogne, and it's a history of the 110th Infantry Regiment and the good work that they did. There are no real examples of people not fighting. I mean, they fought well. Very often what happens is that the picture of a defeat is created by rear echelon troops rushing to the rear. Now, they're supposed to be doing that, you know, but if they wouldn't howl about defeat, we've been overrun, you know, would probably help a lot, because you get an impression of, you know, total institutional collapse. It didn't happen that way. You know, most of the problems why the 104th Division got trapped was that people keep fighting and run out of ammo, and they don't get out soon enough. And those of us who've had some real or theoretical experience know that withdrawing under enemy pressure is about the toughest thing you can do. And you should have, you fall back by echelons, you're supposed to be covered by artillery. It takes a lot of careful synchronization, which is pretty tough. And I think the 28th Division certainly had nothing to apologize for, nor did the 104th. They just got trapped.
What was the relative experience level of the troops on either side that they were facing?
Well, the 104th was brand new, so they were all people who had been jammed into being foot soldiers late in the war. The 28th Division still had a pretty good cadre of veterans from the campaign. I think the 28th Division went into action, I think, in early July of 1944, and they'd been pretty heavily engaged over that time. I suspect they'd had a turnover probably of half their strength. So they had certainly more than their share of replacements, but as long as you have a few people around to be lieutenants and sergeants, you'd probably be okay. Mm-hmm.
And the Germans, were they experienced troops?
Well, the Germans are kind of interesting because they had created a new formation called Volksgrenadier Divisions, and they were really sort of some veterans, many wounded on the Eastern Front. But they weren't, they were either too young or too old and inexperienced. Now, on the other hand, if they were part of Panzer formations or Panzer Grenadier formations, then they're reasonably experienced. But the Germans were having manpower problems, so they were picking up service troops, Luftwaffe guys, flak gunners, I mean, whoever they could get their hands on, and, you know, sticking them to the front. And so the behavior of the German infantry particularly is pretty uneven. I mean, there's some things that, for example, one German formation launched an assault on one of the outposts of Bastogne without a reconnaissance and discovered, much to their dismay, that they had run into a field being used by the Belgians to sort out cattle. And so there were barbed wire fences back and forth across this field that were undiscovered until guys got hit and fell into them. The Germans certainly were past the Superman stage in the fall of 1944. That doesn't mean that they weren't very good. They were, particularly in the use of assault guns and tanks and support infantry attacks and things like that. I think looking back at the campaign, the thing that stood out to me was the fact that there never was a really big, well-coordinated attack on Bastogne that threatened the entire position. Hit over here, hit over here. And as long as you have the interior lines of communication open, you can begin to move people. Now, in the case of Bastogne, I think there were 8 or 9 field artillery battalions that were fundamentally stationed around the town and had access to the road networks. And so McAuliffe, who was an artilleryman, CG, acting CG of the 101st, was perfectly happy to switch the gunners to where they would be most effective. He also had the remnants of Combat Command B of the 10th Armored Division, another combat command from the 9th Armored Division. So he had some tanks and TDs that were available as well, and in considerable numbers. Their problem was fundamentally ammunition shortages, which more or less alleviated by an airdrop on the 23rd of December. But ammunition shortages were something that continued to plague the defenders.
Well, now, before this all happened, had Bastogne suffered greatly from the war, or was it a fairly normal place? You had American headquarters there, soldiers.
Yeah, it was another Belgian town. I don't think anybody thought it was very important, except for the fact that it sits in the southern part of the Ardennes and this road network. And the road network is still there. And you're not going to go in any direction, whether it's towards the Rhine or back, without, in a sense, got to go through Bastogne. And there were other, Saint-Vite was the same way. There are these about 4 or 5 road junctions in this whole area of operations that are pretty important. Germans knew that, Americans knew that. That's why they pushed troops into Saint-Vite up north, which the Americans finally got pushed out of. Mm-hmm. These guys were professionals. They could read maps and they could calculate distances. And so it's not too tough to figure out where you need to put people. Eisenhower knew this right away, as a matter of fact.
Right. Right. Well, you mentioned the civilians periodically. Do they, where are they while this is happening?
They're
hiding in basins?
Trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, just heart-wrenching stories about Belgians who really are innocents, who get caught in the crossfire and some shot by the Germans. One girl in Bastogne was a volunteer nurse. In fact, she appears in one of the episodes of Band of Brothers. And she was given a parachute to make into a wedding dress. And she was killed in a bombing raid, and they buried her in the parachute. There's a tearjerker around every corner, but it really, really did happen. And many of the Belgian civilians, I don't know exactly what the number of casualties, Peter does, I've just forgotten them. But it's significant. There are at least 2 major bombing raids on Bastogne. And one of them, in fact, knocked out the division hospital, and with severe casualties to both the wounded and to the medical staff. So it's, there was nobody who was safe. And very often people who thought they were wounded and should be evacuated, they couldn't be because they were cut off. They said, the hell with it, give me a rifle, I'm going back to the front. It's a lot less dangerous being a wounded rifleman than it is staying in the hospital as a casualty.
So you got the Germans coming down from the north for this?
Well, primarily from the east and the northeast to begin with, and then they begin to encircle the town both by moving to the south of the city and then to around the north to the west. I mean, the position is technically surrounded about the 22nd of December, 23rd of December. The 4th Armored Division gets people into the city about 48 hours later, so it's not as if this is not the Alamo. This is not Troy. You know, it is, you know, they are technically, they're technically cut off, but it was a temporary condition. In fact, even before the 101st got into the city and set up defensive positions, Patton, for one, was already planning, you know, a thrust north. One of the things to remember is that Georgie would do these things, but always with an ulterior motive. In his case,
I'm shocked to hear this.
Yeah, in Georgie's case, what he wanted to do was to take 2 corps of his 3rd Army and push all the way across the base of the Bulge, which is the way you eliminate penetrations. So Bastogne was just a place he was going to relieve as a part of a plan, a larger plan to keep going north and presumably cut off the better part of both of these German armies. And he was very distressed when he wasn't allowed to do that.
Should he have been?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, part of the problem is that Montgomery gets an operational role. And Bradley, of course, was furious at this because it basically took his control of the battle away and gave it to Monty. And Monty, you know, came in and cleansed the temple. You know, I'm here, lucky Americans. I'm here to save you all. And the battle was really an American-German battle. 30 Corps from the British 1st Army, I think, got involved to some degree, but even the reinforcements that basically started the counteroffensive to eliminate the Bulge were largely American troops. And there's still some debate about, you know, why did Monty say the things he did. There's one theory that what he said was actually recorded by Chester Wilmot, who was a British correspondent, and picked up by Goebbels and rewritten in such a way so that they had Monty criticizing the Americans. Well, he had, but not with the same fury that apparently this doctored statement held. I'm sure all of us know people in real life who probably mean well most of the time, but they have an uncanny ability to say things that piss you off.
And, some of us do that.
Well, but, you know, it's an unfortunate habit that Field Marshal Montgomery never worked too hard to correct. He apologized later and said he'd been misunderstood, that he hadn't really won the war by himself. But it was one of the things the Germans, in some cases, counted on. You know, just like Napoleon thought that in the Waterloo campaign that he'd get the Dutch and the Brits fighting each other, not him. And I think, you know, it was a German sort of strategic assumption that if you're fighting allies, you can find ways to split them, and it goes back to Frederick the Great, actually, at least, which is that there's always a chance of breaking up a coalition and you get bigger results than you might otherwise imagine by fragmenting the alliance that you're facing. And I think that's at least part of Hitler's thinking.
So discuss the American disposition, and if you will, you've got the Germans coming in from the east and then the northeast and then eventually sort of around. And you mentioned that Patton was out there and was reversing course. So what were the friendlies doing when this happened?
Well, the 8th Corps, which was in the path of the German advance, was fighting to hold on. I mean, the corps commander was Troy Middleton, who doesn't get enough credit, I think, for his own actions during this period. Being from Louisiana, at least temporarily so, I have to say something nice about Troy Middleton. You know, he was actually from Mississippi, but he became, pre-war, he was a vice president and fiscal officer at LSU, and post-war, he became the president of LSU. Now, he was a West Point graduate. He'd served in the regular Army 27 years. In 1918, at the age of 29, he was the youngest colonel and regimental commander in the AEF. He's a real deal. And he was called back to active duty in about 1939, and his rise was meteoric. Commanded the 45th Infantry Division in North Africa and Italy, Sicily. And you take a look at Troy Middleton, and he looks like a university vice president, you know, overworked, skinny, big glasses, you know. But he was the real deal, and he didn't panic or anything like that, and he grabbed on as many units as he could to put together a defense force, because he knew that the two divisions, the two infantry divisions he controlled, were likely to be ineffective pretty fast as they were. And he was all for, you know, getting help, which meant from Patton's Third Army. And Patton had a corps, the Third Corps, under John Milligan, that was in reserve. So he didn't really have to disengage them from a campaign. He simply moved them north to Arlon. There are two big roads from Neufchâteau and Arlon to Bastogne, and there's still some debate as to which road Patton should have taken. It happened that the guy who endowed a chair that I held at Ohio State was the executive officer of the 22nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion, so their M7 Priest 105 track vehicles, and he was there. And he said the road from Arlon was much better, but they ended up on the road to Neufchâteau. But Patton put all three combat commands of the 4th Armored Division parallel and committed, and which was pretty daring. But Patton always worked on the assumption that if he was about 48 hours quicker than the other guy, he'd be in good shape, and a pretty good assumption on his part. 4th Armored Division was a very, very good unit, and they've just shut down their Veterans Association, and we're going to have all their papers at the World War II Museum. But they were really elite armored division. They'd been commanded by a guy named John Wood, whose nickname was Professor P, who'd been relieved. And the official story was he was exhausted. Now, that's code for meaning he didn't like his corps commander. And so he was tired. No, he was smarter. And they've had arguments about how the campaign in Lorraine should go, and his corps commander relieved him, and Patton had to back up, felt he had to back up the corps commander. Patton knew that Wood shouldn't have been relieved, so he assigned Hugh Gaffey, who was the major general, who was Patton's chief of staff for the 3rd Army, to be the commander, the CG of the 4th Armored Division. So they knew that they were, you know, the guys upstairs really liked them. And they were a very, very good outfit, and they had tremendous esprit. We had a 4th Armored Division reunion at the museum, and I'm telling you, I thought the guys were going to jump into one of our Shermans and drive it off into to the French Quarter, you know, and shoot it up. They were tough guys. So we were fortunate in the fact that they had a really good armored unit. There was a 26th Infantry Division, 80th Infantry Division, part of the 3rd Corps, and they kind of, I think what's interesting is a hint of what Patton had in mind was he pointed them at this German 7th Army, which was supporting the Ardennes offensive. But that's all the way to the east, and that tells you that what Patton had in mind, you know, was to break off, you know, to seal the penetration at the place where it had begun, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what you're supposed to do. So he had a big scheme that meant relieving Bastogne, which he'd been told to do, but he was ready to do a lot more, much more than that.
So discuss how do we relieve Bastogne? What exactly happened? How did it happen? And we need to tell the story of the 101st.
One can criticize German operational techniques to some degree, but I can tell you they could fight, and they could. The advantages the terrain gave the defenders of Bastogne worked for the Germans, who were now defending their positions around Bastogne. So it was not a piece of cake to get in there. So the 4th Division, they got one combat command into the town. They were able to get a convoy of 40-some trucks in with the supplies. They got ambulances out. But there was another 5 or 6 days of pretty heavy fighting because the Germans kept coming in against these restricted avenues that were open. There was only one to begin with, or two later. And so it was not a foregone conclusion that the Germans were going to throw up their hands and go away, because they certainly didn't. And the reasons were that if the Germans began to withdraw out of the Bulge, they still needed Bastogne, and they needed the road network. So that the job of, restored 8th Corps and then the 3rd Corps from 3rd Army was, to try to close the gap to some degree to make the German withdrawal more difficult than it might otherwise have been. There were a number of advantages. The Americans had artillery superiority eventually, and close air support, which was devastating. If you're an artilleryman, the worst thing in the world is not have air superiority, because it's bad guys and close air support to knock out big artillery concentrations. It was not a relieving the city, quote, saving the 101st was okay, but again, there was a bigger purpose, which was to keep the pressure on, the German 5th Panzer Army, make sure that, not that it went any farther, because it wasn't going any farther, but make it hard for it to get out. Mm-hmm. Patton and others, said this was a terrific opportunity because they had, 40 divisions, best divisions in the German army, more or less in a sack, and that they could close it. You might have something that happened like in the Ruhr the next spring, where you're able to encircle, major German formations and force them to surrender. That didn't happen in this case. And everybody blamed Monty for doing this too slow. Ridgway was the commander of the 18th Airborne Corps. He was part of the counteroffensive, and he continued to moan for the rest of his professional life about the fact that if they let the Americans run this operation the way they should have, they would have not just pushed the Germans out of the Bulge, but they would have cut them off closer to the border.
How do you assess that judgment?
Well, I think, who knows?
That's good.
let's put it this way. It probably was worth the effort. Were the forces available? Yes, but you would have to pull most of the Third Army up from its positions, which were far to the east and on the Rhine, which they were holding eventually with one corps, the 20th. You'd probably have needed to get access to the U.S. 9th Army, which was to the north. You needed maybe to pull some troops from 7th Army, which was to the south. You certainly would have had to make some pretty major reallocations of forces. And when you start doing that, then the generals start howling.
Well, there's one story, of course, that everyone knows, and that was the General McCullough's response to the surrender. So give us some detail and some color, and I think it would be really interesting.
Well, it was, I think, 23rd December, and it was a point where the situation for the 101st was fairly dire. They had been pushed back towards Bastogne. They were running short of ammunition. It wasn't altogether clear that the 4th Armored Division was going to reach them within the next 48 hours, which it did. And the German Corps commander, actually without any authorization, thought that he would offer American terms. So he sent a couple of colonels and a lieutenant who spoke English, and they drove a captured Jeep, I think, which is not psychologically a good idea. You know, yeah. kind of tease well, you
how,
off.
How did they do that without getting machine guns?
Well, they put up a white flag and drove in.
All right.
And they were met by a regimental commander of the 327th Glider Infantry Regiment. And they took the lieutenant, whose English was pretty good, and kept the other officers on the outpost. And they drove him in and talked to McAuliffe. He actually talked to Henry Kennard, who was the G3 of the division. If you do Vietnam War history, you know that Hank Kennard commanded the 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile. A very, very fine officer. And he met this lieutenant, and lieutenant delivered the letter. And he said, "What's this? You know, well, we're offering you surrender terms." "Huh? What?" And McAuliffe comes in and reads the letter and says, "Nuts." And so the lieutenant, whose English apparently was pretty good, didn't understand what nuts meant. Well, then I had to explain to him it was not, he says, "Is this affirmative or negative?" "Yeah, it's negative."
You know, and insultingly negative.
Yeah, and they sent him on his way. And he didn't really want to report it quite that way to the colonel that he was working for. But Kennard went out with him and then explained to the German plenipotentiaries that no, they were going to surrender. And actually, the legend says that he asked them if they wanted to surrender. Kind of cool. I don't know what people think of Maxwell D. Taylor. I'm not one of his great admirers. He was not there. He'd been in Washington on official duty. I don't think they missed him, to tell you the truth. Taylor knew talent, and he had a lot better help in the division staff than Ridgway did in the 82nd. Ridgway wanted to do everything himself. I met Ridgway when he was in his declining years, but he still had that charisma, like nobody can do what I can do better, period. End of discussion. Taylor was the same way, except he was also lazy. So he said, "I can do this all myself, but I've got other better things to do, like play tennis and practice my French." So he had, you know, a very, very good staff. So 101st was exceptionally well served by their senior officers, most of whom had parachuted into Normandy and on D-Day. So they knew their stuff. And they'd survived the Operation Market Garden, which was also a huge test. The 101st was the least damaged of the three divisions who jumped in Market Garden. So they were in pretty good shape. But they had, you just take a look at who the battalion commanders are, regimental commanders, principal staff officers, and you're looking at the leadership of the U.S. Army for the next 20 years.
Well, the story ends happily from our point of view, or at least continues. They're pushed back. So what? What is the effect on the ground for the Americans and the Germans?
Well, I think there are two. One is that it gave the American response at least a kind of a solid rock to build around in organizing first to stop the offensive and then the counterattack from the southern flank of the salient. And I think the other is that the exploits of the 101st were very well publicized. How many of you saw the movie Battleground, 1947? I think it kind of starts there, but the 101st had an absolutely terrific press. And so I think it really pointed out that we were just as tough as the Germans were and that we had nothing to apologize for. That this was a temporary setback and that we should all look at it as an opportunity, not a disaster, which I think was correct. And so it took on a certain amount of symbolic importance, I think. Professionally, the defense of Saint Vite by Bruce Clark and the combat command of the 7th Armored Division is a piece of work. I mean, I don't know how they held it as long as they did. If you want to examine real professional conduct of a withdrawal, that's the one to look at. But who the hell ever heard of Saint Vite, you know, because eventually they gave it up. They're you know, episodes throughout the campaign which are really quite inspiring, and I think Bastogne falls in that category.
Clearly. Well, we're about to go to questions and answers, but before we do, I wonder if you'd like to unburden yourself on sort of a big picture. So what should we take away from this discussion about Bastogne?
Well, I think it was part of a successful response to a very daring German effort to sort of redress the situation in the Western Front. I think the reason people were surprised at the high command level was that in the long run it wasn't real smart. These were the best divisions of the German army that were left. If they had been used to defend the Rhine frontier intact, it would have been a lot tougher to get into Germany. And so in a sense, Hitler was doing us a favor by putting them into a situation where we could fight them, on terms that were more likely to work for us than it was for them. I think von Rundstedt knew that. I mean, he didn't. I think he regretted having his name attached to this Wacht am Rhein, this operation. Certainly, he would not have done it. I admire Rundstedt. If you see pictures of him, you'll notice that he's still wearing the tunic of a colonel of Imperial German Infantry Regiment. It's got white piping. Now his field marshal's batons and all that stuff are proper, but he always insisted that he was part of another army, not the one that he was being forced to serve.
Could you quickly tell us who you think the most impressive commanders were on both sides of that engagement?
That's pretty tough to do, Jay. I mean, at this point of the war, the people who had been in action either in the Mediterranean and then from Normandy on are pretty competent. I mean, there are 7 or 8 American Corps commanders who are very, very good. I never been an Omar Bradley admirer, and I think he was overrated. I think Hodges certainly was. But beyond that, most of these guys were pretty solid and had relevant experience. World War I experiences to some degree help, but being a division commander is a whole lot different than being a battalion commander.
Right.
I've been a battalion commander, and that was tough. I can't imagine what it'd be like to try to make a division work, the way you want it to.
Amongst the Germans?
Well, I don't think I'm knowledgeable enough to make judgments there. They certainly were experienced.
Yeah.
I think that the one difference in fighting on the Western Front was the lack of air support for the Germans.
Yeah.
Rommel knew that was a real difference. And guys who had fought only on the Eastern Front had done so without really worrying about air superiority. And that certainly was not what happened to them in France in 1944.
Great. Well, I have a suspicion that this audience has a number of questions, and I'll be astonished if you do not. I will now turn to questions and answers for Professor Millett.
I have a question about the field commands, lower level, the sergeants and lieutenants. So I know much has been made about the fact that this was a surprise, the bulge in general. But was there any thinking at any level that there would be more than just resistance from the Germans, that there would be something at the level of an offensive attack somewhere?
Yes.
Were any of them trained to deal with actual switching from offense to defense? Because we see lots of innovation and some commanders making innovative ways of dealing with this. And once the Germans ran out of steam and the Americans went back on the offense, it was great. But I don't know if any of them were actually trained to deal with becoming a defensive army until the Germans ran out of the steam once this began.
Well, first of all, it's one thing to look, and I've done this kind of work. You can measure potential enemy capability. Order of battle. Tough to do sometimes, but it can be done. The trouble is, what is the intent?
Exactly. Yes.
Why, what are they going to do with these forces? Now, it got to the point about the 13th or 14th of December where people at the division and corps level were saying, I think they're going to attack us. That's not enough time to do much. Because the decisions that are necessary to respond go all the way to Dwight D. Eisenhower. And he's got to become convinced that everything else he's doing at the time has to be stopped, and all those forces have to be redirected to a threat that is possible, maybe likely, but hasn't occurred yet. Now, that takes real guts, and most commanders want to wait and see. Now, in the case of Ike and Bradley and these others, it took them about 48 hours to figure out this was the real deal. That's not unusual. I've studied, you know, the Chinese and the Korean War and North Korean attacks, and there's always somebody, in fact, a lot of people, who figured out that they're about to be attacked. The question is, it takes somebody like Douglas MacArthur to decide that this is something that has to be responded to. MacArthur didn't respond well to any of these things, ever. And so, you know, it's very difficult to find some commander who's ready to say, hey, we made a mistake, you know, we're in the wrong place with the wrong troops, and now I've got to redirect 200,000 troops and, you know, redo my lines of supply, and our logistics have to be changed. You don't do that kind of thing unless you're really sure that you've got something to deal with. And it took about 48 hours for the guys with all the stars to figure out that that's what they had to deal with. It's not a war game. It's not playing with little trinkets on a board. You know, it's real life and real people and real forces, and commanders are quite properly cautious about making decisions. And the reason is, it is hard to unscrew a military mistake because they ripple. And everybody else wants to respond. So the general makes a bad call, and everybody's trying to make it work. Trying to make it work. And it gets worse and it worse. It cascades. Hell, I've seen it. I'm the umpire at the National Training Center. And all it takes is just one company to do something weird, and suddenly a whole brigade is doing stupid stuff. I mean, it's really, all you have to do is see this happen, you know, and you're going to sympathize with commanders because it is really hard to stop a screw-up like this, or somebody's made a bad judgment or just had bad luck, whatever. And that's why I think there's innate caution, you know, among military commanders. George Patton was cautious too, but he was very theatrical. And so I read his papers pretty carefully when they were published, and the guy was a solid professional. I mean, he could do time, distance, and, you know, he did all the right stuff. But he made it seem as if it was just off the top of his head, or he was inspired, you know. Well, he had a hell of a good staff. Colonel Cook, who was his G2, was damn near a genius, expert on the German armed forces. And he was well served by a very, very fine Army level staff, which had been with him since North Africa. So you can't be fooled by theatrics. Even Douglas MacArthur, very theatrical. But then you take a look at his staff during World War II or in Far East Command, and they're all, except for Charles Willoughby, they're all solid professionals, very highly.
That was the one that should have been more professional.
Yeah, well, that's sure enough.
But let's stay down at the lower level now.
Captain Winters and the Band of Brothers?
Yeah, good guy.
What's your perspective on their role in this?
Well, he's a very competent battalion commander. I mean, he'd been the company commander of EZ Company, 2nd Battalion, 506, the infantry, parachute infantry regiment. He became the S3 of the battalion, whose commander was a dope. So he was de facto the commander of the battalion, although he was technically the operations officer. I think very, very competent guy, you know. But he gets a lot of attention because we get a book about him, and then people write memoirs. I think every surviving officer and NCO of an easy company has now written a book. I think it's easy to think that they're somehow exceptional when they're probably not. They're like the other airborne units of the time. They just happen to have a lot of people who could write or wanted to, anyway. I think he deserves all of the credit he receives for being the kind of very good company grade officer, battalion commander, which he clearly was. I think, you know, Steve did a good job with his book. I think there are other, you know, Winters wrote his own memoirs, and then there's been a biography written about him. So we got lots of Richard Winters information. It seems to square pretty well. One of my sons actually went and met him, and my son Douglas was a pretty tough act to fool, since he revealed Enron as a house of cards. He liked him. If my son liked him, I had no reason to doubt his judgment. But I think the thing to remember is there were lots of Dick Winters in the U.S. Army. To some degree, he represents the citizen soldier in, you know, positions of command who want to win the war but get the hell out of the Army. And that's, you know, pretty typical at the time.
After Eisenhower makes the decision to split command between Montgomery and Bradley, is Bradley really fighting the battle on the South, or is he turning it over to Patton? And specifically, is it his decision to have Patton to go through Bastogne rather than further east at the base of the Bulge?
You know, I've already made clear in speech and writing that I'm not a great admirer of Omar Bradley's. He tends to sulk a lot and blame other people for his mistakes and, you know, did things that are not very attractive as a commander. I'll tell a story. Bradley had a tooth problem. He had bad teeth. He decided that a captain or major interwar period. He had all of his teeth pulled to cure this condition, and then found out from another dentist that it was unnecessary. Now, you got to wonder about the judgment of a guy who has all his teeth pulled on the basis of one opinion of an Army dentist. And so I always sort of thought that was a clue to Bradley's personality, that there was something there that just didn't connect somehow. He was aggravated at the movie Patton, which he and his wife were heavily involved in, because it didn't make him a hero. Hey, I like Carl Malden to play me. I mean, I think, you know, he did okay, but he had a serious ego problem of some kind, and he probably should never have been more than a corps commander. But he got lucky in North Africa. He was there. Ike liked them. They were buddies, and he got some opportunities. And I think he was not a risk taker, and Patton knew that. But Patton also knew he could intimidate him. And so that if it came to somebody going up against Ike or Beetle Smith or people at the Schaeff headquarters, Patton always felt that he was going to win the argument. And he usually did. And I think if when Bradley becomes an Army Group commander and he gets Courtney Hodges as first Army commander, it's like getting a clone. A Bradley clone. Well, if it had been Bill Simpson, who was a Ninth Army, that would have been a lot better, because Simpson was the real deal and very fine commander and very forceful. Bradley was kind of a marshmallow in a lot of situations. He tended to be very pessimistic about whatever the operational situation happened to be. And it was just a kind of a state of mind, I think. which was unfortunate, I think, because the truth is the communication system was set up in such a way that he couldn't have commanded the forces on the northern part of the salient. And they weren't real happy that Monty got the deal. But it seemed as if that was really the only alternative. And it was negotiated between Montgomery's headquarters and Ike's headquarters. Bradley was not a part of the negotiation. That was, you know, maybe where things got a little touchy. And you can sympathize with Bradley when suddenly he loses control of about half his army to the Brits. Oh, my Lord. But it was really something that had to be done because they knew that whatever Monty did, he would do it all. He'd throw everything in. Didn't need him, but he didn't know quite yet that that was good.
With that parting thought, I would like to thank Professor Millett for his very insightful and entertaining remarks. And the audience for your questions.
Thank you to Drs. Millett and Williams for a riveting discussion. And thank you to Citadel Securities for sponsoring the 2019 On War Symposium. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.